Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of December. We do want to thank all of you. We had this mini pledge drive during Joy's show this morning from 6 till 9 o'clock, and it was a whopper of a pledge drive. We got to do all of them this way. Then we wouldn't have to do long pledge drives ever. We had great response to it. $184,000 in 3 hours. So we thank all of you who contributed to Wisconsin Public Radio during that little bitty pledge drive this morning. We had 2,200 members making tax-deductible year-end gifts to WPR and 500 new members to the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. So that was just terrific. Thank you very much for all of your generosity. You'll keep us rolling. We have an extremely interesting hour ahead. The authors of A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. David Rode is joining us. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, reporter for The New York Times, who started reporting on Afghanistan shortly after the horrors of September 11th. And he was doing a follow-up, and it was shortly after he got married to Kristen Mulvihill, and he got kidnapped. And it's a horrendous story. And he was kidnapped by a Taliban commander for many, many months. He finally escaped. And so the story is what he went through and also what she went through trying to keep her life together, continue with a job, and figure out the very complicated negotiations that would have to take place in order for him to be released. So this is what's found in this story, and it's quite riveting. And plus you get, because David is an expert on Pakistan and Afghanistan and the history of the country and a bit critical of what the United States has done or their lack of accomplishment in Afghanistan. So all of that is included in this book as well. We should also mention that David Holbrook was involved in a couple instances when David spent time in a Serbian prison and also in Afghanistan, so I'm sure they'll have thoughts about him. At any rate, they're both with us this hour. David is with us, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, co-author of A Rope and a Prayer. He's also author of Endgame, and he won his first Pulitzer in 1996 for uncovering the massacre in Bosnia for the Christian Science Monitor, his second in 2009 as part of the New York Times team covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kristen Mulvihill, they are married to each other, has been a fashion and photography editor at many women's magazines. She was the photography director of Cosmopolitan magazine. She's also a painter and an illustrator. David, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I just read your story yesterday, and I feel like I'm there right now. I know you're beyond it in some ways, but my gosh, what a story that is. Kristen, thank you so much for being with us today as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Why don't we start with David Holbrook, because he passed away, and I know that he was instrumental in your life, David, in a couple of instances, trying to figure out how to get you out of being kidnapped in Afghanistan and also in Serbia.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. He made these tremendous efforts twice on my behalf. And I'll be honest, after I managed to escape from captivity the second time around in Afghanistan, and calling him, though, was one of the after we'd escaped, was one of the things I kind of dreaded most, because I expected him to be furious and say, you know, every time I get a very, you know, difficult diplomatic assignment, you complicate it by becoming a captive. And I called him and apologized to him, and, you know, and he has been nothing but absolutely gracious and warm and, you know, to us since I returned from my captivity in Pakistan. And, you know, there was a change in him. You know, I think the image of him as the bulldozer is so abrasive is exaggerated, but, you know, I think he became more and more of a statesman over the years, and, you know, I was just so touched by how he handled the second captivity in particular.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's set the stage. The two of you are just married. Kristen, you know what his life is, but you assume it's going to change. He's a reporter. He goes to places where horrendous things are happening in the world, and there's some danger involved. So you had accepted that, right?
Yes. I mean, he was a war correspondent. I knew that when I married him. He was working on a book, which he was hoping was going to sort of bring him a little bit away from the war corresponding, and this was the final trip to the region for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was the irony of it all. It was his last trip.
But you couldn't. There was a story that you just didn't have yet, right, David?
Yeah, I would say in this case, I kind of let competition get the best of me. The Taliban had really were really resurgent, and I felt that for the book to be as thorough as possible, I really needed to get a Taliban commander, you know, that side of the conflict, and have a, you know, hopefully have them serve as a character almost in the book. But everything went completely wrong.
It sure did. But you checked out a little bit how safe this was going to be for you. You checked with journalists, and it seems like you got maybe 70% saying go ahead.
Yeah, this Taliban commander had done interviews with two other foreign journalists. At first there was a proposal to do the interview pretty far from Kabul. He then agreed to do it just an hour outside the city. And I finally, the night before the interview, met with a foreign journalist who had interviewed this Taliban commander twice. And the Taliban commander did not kidnap her. She's a European journalist. She said to me, you know, you are in more danger because you're American, but I don't think he'll kidnap you. And unfortunately, we were all wrong.
Mm-hmm. And if you had been sitting at that, can you imagine if you had been sitting at the same meeting with that journalist, that you're American, he probably won't kidnap you. What would you have told your husband, Kristen?
It's funny. I mean, I don't know that I could say, in all honesty, that I would have stopped him.
Uh-huh.
I think I knew that competition had maybe gotten the best of him, and I wouldn't have been thrilled. But I also... I don't know. I think I might have thought it made no sense to try to stop him.
Right.
Yeah.
And the reason that European journalist said you're in more danger because you're an American, why more danger for an American?
I guess a sense among Europeans that they're seen as, I don't know, more neutral by the Taliban. I don't agree with that perspective. They've kidnapped many Europeans as well. But I guess that was her sense. But she had had, two long interviews with him and really didn't think there'd be a problem. And I think she was well-intentioned. I mean, in hindsight, I think all of the previous interviews were probably part of a setup where he was trying to gradually gain the trust of journalists, do a few interviews, not kidnap anybody, and then, when the right person came along, grab them.
Yeah. And you were the guy. Wow.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. Now, you really knew Afghanistan. You had been covering, go back for a while, till right after September 11. That's when you went to Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, I was actually in New York on 9/11 and at, at the Trade Center when the towers fell. And then 2 weeks later, my editor sent me over to cover the basically U.S. attack on Afghanistan. I was in Kabul when the Taliban fell in 2001, and there really was this sense of hope among Afghans. There was really a desire for a sort of a more moderate and modern Afghanistan, and I really feel that what's unfolded there since then is a tragedy. There was a real opportunity, but it's been missed so far.
Mm-hmm. So the book that you were doing was to look at what the Americans had done or hadn't done, what's happened in all those years.
Yeah, I was trying to write the definitive account of the American effort since 2001, and I, sort of an interview too far, if you will.
Right. Well, I guess that some of that is in this book, but there's another book, right? There will be another book that looks at exactly that. You just need time to do that.
Well, I do. I mean, one thing is that in the wake of all this, I have decided, and I decided this during the kidnapping, that my days as a war correspondent are over. So I won't be reporting in conflict zones, and I won't be returning to Afghanistan, as long as the war there is continuing, or Pakistan. So that complicates things. But we have tried to include both things in this book, sort of the story of the kidnapping, the problems families face in these situations or in any kind of crisis, and then also the kind of an analysis of what's gone wrong in Afghanistan and Pakistan since 2001.
And you must be happy, Kristen, to hear that his days as a war correspondent are over.
Yes, and it's that much better that he's come to that conclusion on his own. I didn't have to say anything.
I guess if you're going to come to that conclusion, if you'd been through what this guy's been through, you would have said, oh, my gosh, I can't do this anymore. When did you receive word? First of all, you didn't know that he was doing this interview. When did you receive word? And tell me about the elaborate system that was in place, that the notes that he left and his brother was to be contacted. How you got word that something was terribly wrong?
I actually had started a job at Cosmopolitan Magazine about 2 weeks before. So I was at work. His brother Lee contacted me, and Lee had received word from the FBI that David went to an interview in Kabul and didn't return. I believe this had been reported to the embassy in Kabul. And they then contacted Lee, who had been the emergency contact for the family. We hadn't updated that because we'd just been married. I later found out, I guess about 12 hours later, after rushing out of the office to meet with my brother-in-law, meet with the FBI, and meet with the Times, I had a note that David left for me at the bureau in Kabul, just stating that he was taking a risk, but he really thought it would be all right. And what to do if anything happened. You know, there was a book advance that he had, so I was, you know, to use money for that if I needed it. Separately, he left a note for a colleague in Kabul stating that, you know, he didn't want this to be public if anything happened to him. So I kind of used that as a guideline in the early days. And then, you know, the family decided that we did not want the case made public. And the Times backed us up on that, even though it went against every instinct they had as journalists to report.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And why didn't you want it public?
Well, you know, as it dragged on, we realized he was being held by militants, not by a legitimate government. And we really had the sense from some of the communications. Number one, the kidnappers in the early days said they didn't want it public. And then as it progressed, you know, they were making video demands, you know, to our government, and we really felt that if we made it public, they would really try to use the case as a way to negotiate directly with the U.S. government, which our government doesn't negotiate with terrorists. So we just feared it would be disastrous, and it was a decision we did not take lightly. We revisited it every week based on what was going on in the world. And based on communications in his case, but I really think the camaraderie that his colleagues showed in honoring our privacy, I think that really saved his life.
And we should remind people what you were going through. You had just been married. You just started a brand new job at a time when you're supposed to work up many, many hours, and you're dealing with this whole other thing, and you can't be very public about it.
Exactly. I was still actually going to work for the first 6 months of this, you know, which was planning photo shoots at Cosmo. So we're talking about bachelors and things like that.
Oh,
and in between planning shoots, I was ducking out of the office to meet with the New York Times. I was receiving, you know, communications from the FBI. They trained me how to answer the phone in case I got a call at home, which I wound up doing later. I got a call from the captors and two calls in the course of 7 months from David. I tried to go to D.C. along with David's family. We met with U.S. government officials, and later in the case, we met with Pakistani officials just to see, you know, if there was anything anybody could do to pressure the people holding David, if the Pakistani government could pressure them. So it was really a mix of just two very extreme worlds, and ultimately it became too much to manage both, and I wound up taking a leave of absence from work to just work full time on his case.
Yeah, you had to.
Yeah.
And without giving too much away here, except that we have to because we're doing an interview, David, you want to get this interview with this Taliban commander, and he's the guy you're holding out for, and for those who are reading the book right now, don't listen to me for the next minute. We find out maybe halfway through the book or a little more that this guy has betrayed you. This guy has betrayed you.
Yeah, he pretended. When we were first kidnapped, we didn't know who had grabbed us. We thought it was just some commander who had, you know, his men had stopped our car as we drove down the road, and we never actually made it to the person we were supposed to interview. And then several months into the kidnapping, I realized that, in fact, the person who invited me to the interview had set us up and grabbed us.
Wow.
And he had covered his face and used his name and threatened my two Afghan colleagues that if they told me the truth about who had kidnapped us, you know, he said he told them he would decapitate them.
And you're thinking for a long time, and tell me how you finally realized who this guy was. You thought he was the guy who was going to protect you for a long time.
I kept thinking that there was this, the guy who invited us to the interview was this sort of powerful and you know, I'd been told sort of moderate commander, and that he would be out there working for our release, and this rogue commander who had just grabbed us as we drove down the road, you know, that he would somehow be brought in line. And it all sort of fell apart just after Christmas when I, you know, based on some of the things he said. And then, you know, my Afghan colleagues did tell me in the end that, in fact, the person who invited us to the interview had betrayed us and kidnapped us. And it was, you know, there were just long, you know, long periods of sort of these false hopes, and then they would come crashing to an end. And it was sort of like a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with, I know that you were not raised in a particularly religious fashion, and you were dealing with people who were highly religious in their own weird form, but here you were praying because the captivity went on and on and on and on, but you knew what had happened to people like Daniel Pearl. And Kristen, I know you mm-hmm. got in touch with Daniel Pearl's wife at some point.
Yes, I did.
How did you deal with the horrors that could happen? I mean, you could have been beheaded. I'm sorry, but you could have been. You had to think about all of that.
Well, I think, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, the human brain kind of switches into survival mode, I found. And no matter how bleak the situation, I would find that my mind would sort of shift to a narrative of survival. And, you know, people, you know, in the United States are confronted with this, you know, all the time in terms of someone's diagnosed with, let's say, cancer. They don't know what's going to happen. They're immediately faced with, you know, their own mortality. And in the end, you know, in many ways, they don't have any control over the situation.
Right.
So, you know, many people, you know, go through similar circumstances and you just keep going. I did, as you talked about, in terms of religion, I remain deeply skeptical of, you know, organized religion. I've, you know, seen religion in extremes used to carry out, you know, horrible acts
yes.
of cruelty. But when I was in captivity, I ended up sort of devising this set of prayers that I said to myself each day. They were, you know, asking, you know, praying for my wife and family and my fellow captives, and that, you know, this would all end safely. And it was something that the guards couldn't control. I could always do it on my own. I repeated these prayers to me silently, and it did sort of calm and center me every day I did it. And I, you know, to this day, I don't know, you know, if some great, you know, God heard my prayers and reached down and comforted me, or if prayer is just sort of a psychological trick that helps someone that's in a situation where they have no control. But it, you know, it worked on that level. I think, you know, religion in moderation is a positive force in our world. But, you know, extremist religions can be very, very dangerous.
And there are very few people in the world who have seen extremism the way that you have. How did you deal with that survival issue, Kristen?
You know, he's right. There really is an instinct that kicks in, and it was just about getting through each moment. I also hated the idea that we were victims of this crime, and so I tried to be as proactive as possible. Originally, like, you know, initially going to work was good, and that it gave me some sense of normalcy and at times comic relief even. but aside from that, you know, my mother came in and stayed for me for weeks at a time. In a crisis, you really lose sight of the basics, and she reminded me to eat, to sleep. She really sort of managed the home those months, and that was tremendously helpful. Prayer played a huge role for me as well. I was a person of faith before the experience. And I really drew upon that, not only to just stay positive, but also to feel connected to David. There was a prayer to St. Francis that I would say at night, which had been one of the hymns that was sung at our wedding. So I would say that to feel more connected to him. And I actually found that, you know, traditional sort of written prayer was helpful when I couldn't find the words and the intention within myself to stay positive. So, you know, in the end, when I realized, no matter what we're doing, you know, all these meetings with officials and trying to communicate with the captors, I really thought the outcome would probably be beyond my control. And prayer was a way to surrender without giving up.
And who were the people who were guiding you? Because you were dealing with some decisions that I can't imagine
We had a large team. It was David's brother, Lee. There was the lawyer from the New York Times worked on the case. We hired a private security team because the FBI, while they could, you know, let us know how the case might progress based on history, they couldn't negotiate. So we hired private contractors to try to negotiate. There was also an expert on Afghanistan and Pakistan named Michael Semple who advised me. I did get conflicting information at times. I didn't feel that any one source kind of knew it all, you know, knew how to negotiate, knew the local culture. So it was very difficult to sift through all that. And we had information coming in, you know, from the ground in Afghanistan and Pakistan that was false. There were many false reports and many, you know, moments of hope where, oh, a deal is going to happen, and we, you know, we wouldn't hear from the captors for 6 weeks at a time. So it was just tremendously difficult.
Yeah. David, and how aware were you of what was going on with Christian?
Twice by phone, and then we were also able to exchange letters once through the International Red Cross. Mm. I didn't really know much, and she did this incredible job during each phone call of sounding incredibly calm,
mm-hmm.
and it really strengthened me. There wasn't any tone of panic in her voice. She sort of, you know, one phone call said, you know, I know everything's going to be all right. And I kind of carried that phrase with me for weeks. And in the letter she wrote me, she included this amazing phrase that simply said, "You must be strong because I am strong."
Hmm.
And that as well kept me going for months. So, you know, she was just spectacular. My captors were even impressed with the amount of love and devotion and determination she showed in this letter that she sent me. They thought that, you know, Westerners in general were sort of hedonists who, you know, really had no patience and only cared about, you know, themselves and the pleasures of this life. So they assumed that she might actually abandon me after a few short
months. Oh my gosh.
And simply move on. So they were impressed by her as well.
And I signed the letter "Love Always" and I underlined "always," and apparently they thought that was really something, that I hadn't left him for another man.
Oh my gosh. And you didn't know you had that kind of strength in you. The very thing that gave him sustenance, you didn't know. When we think about it, we don't know if we're going to be hysterical when we're talking
we
to somebody
really
or
know until you know you're confronted with this, but I will say, you know, it's amazing the reserves you can pull upon, you know, and resiliency of the human spirit. And in staying calm for him, I really felt, you know, we spoke twice. I didn't know each time if it would be the last time we'd ever speak.
Oh, my.
So I wanted him to know that I was all right and to hear that I was calm and could handle the situation and loved him.
Yeah. And tell me about reaching, what is her name again, Daniel Pearl's wife, reaching out to her?
Oh, Marianne, we spoke at the beginning of the case, and she tried to reassure me. You know, there were demands for David in the beginning. It was $25 million and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo. That's what the kidnappers were asking for. And she had told me that with Danny, there were never any demands, so she thought that it was actually a sign of hope that we had demands and maybe there'd be negotiations. And she also, the one bit of advice she gave me was, you know, you'll get opinions from everybody, but, you know, throughout, just follow your gut with your decisions in this case, and that was good advice. And I did hear from her, you know, in the middle of the case, and then after David was released, she was very happy for us, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests, and of course, obviously, David eventually escaped. That's a dramatic story we'll have to get to. We're speaking this hour of the program with the authors of A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. David Rode and Kristen Mulvihill are our guests. The book has just been released, and we're welcoming phone calls for both of them. David also knows a whole lot. Some of the book deals with what's going on in Afghanistan now. Has any progress been made in terms of that country being able to rule itself and be a strong country? What has the American involvement been in Afghanistan? He knows all of that as well, because he is a reporter who has covered the country since September 11th, and he knows the history in addition to this very, very dramatic story of trying to get the final story for his book. So here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, and our lines are open for you. at this very moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Rode, who is the winner of two Pulitzer Prizes in journalism, reporter for the New York Times, the author of Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica. He won his first Pulitzer in 96 for uncovering the massacre in Bosnia for the Christian Science Monitor, and his second in 2009 as part of the New York Times team covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. Kristen Mulvihill has been a fashion and photography editor at many women's magazines. She is a painter and an illustrator, and she is a co-author of A Rope and a Prayer. We go to some phone calls for them now. Brendan in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Brendan.
Oh, hi. I didn't know I was going to be this fast on the
air. There you are, yeah.
Oh, yes. I just wondered one thing. If the guest experts would perhaps speculate on what would have happened had we not abandoned the Mujahideen after they helped fight the Soviets for us back in the 80s. And also, a quick note, I was stricken to hear about that gentleman who was in the past program living out of his car. I heard that in Walmart's, 24-hour Walmart, you can actually stay there free of charge overnight. Thank you.
We did the first hour on homelessness, so somebody called who was living in a van. That's what he's referring to. All right, David, let's go to you on that.
That's a great question. One of the ironies of my case is that the family that kidnapped me, the Haqqanis, the patriarch of the family is Jalaluddin Haqqani. He was funded by the United States government, by the CIA, when he fought the Soviets in the 1980s. And if you remember the book and movie Charlie Wilson's War, about
sure.
the Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson, who got a lot of that funding, Charlie Wilson was taken on a tour of Afghanistan by the Haqqani family. Secretly during the war, Charlie Wilson fired some rockets actually at a Soviet base, and he declared Jalaluddin Haqqani goodness personified. 20 years later, you know, Jalaluddin Haqqani's son kidnapped me and held me captive. They did talk about a sense that the United States had abandoned them after the Soviets withdrew from Afghanistan in 1989 and sort of let the country fall into chaos. And I'm not sure if, you know, if we had stayed, everything, you know, would be, you know, rosy there. But I definitely think it would have given us a lot more credibility. A lot of people don't trust us, and they think that we're, you know, simply, we didn't pay much attention to Afghanistan. We devoted more resources to Iraq. Now we've set some deadlines for when we're going to leave, and so people don't really trust us in the region. They don't feel like we've been serious in what we're trying to do in Afghanistan.
And we've been there so long, haven't we? So long, you would think that we would have been able to do something by now.
Well, it's two things. I mean, three things. You know, we haven't trained. We trained roughly a quarter of the Afghan army is roughly a quarter the size of the Iraqi army that U.S. forces trained. So there's been a much smaller effort in terms of giving the Afghans tools themselves to control the country.
Mm-hmm.
These sanctuaries in Pakistan continue to exist. The U.S. is giving now $2 billion a month to Pakistani military and military aid, and they're not moving in there. And then we've sort of failed to confront the growing corruption in Karzai's government. Things have really gotten dramatically worse since 2006, and there was sort of a really sort of paltry effort until 2006. So it has been a long time, but we haven't used our time well.
Right. Tell me about the companions who were kidnapped with you and how important it was to you, David, to make sure that you all got out alive.
I did insist every time I talked to Kristen, you know, and I told my captors repeatedly that any deal had to be for the three of us. There had been an earlier case of an Italian journalist being kidnapped in southern Afghanistan, and the Taliban had decapitated his driver early in the kidnapping, filmed it, and release that video as a way to pressure the Italian government and the Afghan government to release prisoners in exchange for the freedom of the Italian journalists. That worked, and I was always very afraid that my two colleagues would be killed before me, and you know, I was very lucky that, that all three of us ended up surviving in the end.
Mm-hmm. And we may as well jump to the end here for a moment. You escaped. That was pretty brave of you, what you did.
Well, we never thought it would work. And it wasn't brave in a sense, and it's, you know, I talk about the driver who was with us. Unfortunately, what happened before the escape in the last few months of our captivity, our driver, Assad, started basically cooperating with the guards. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't blame him for what he did. I think he was trying to survive. So we spoke to him a couple times about trying to escape, and he told the guards. So when this third, you know, conversation came up and we had this opportunity, we did not tell the driver, and it was myself and the Afghan journalist that escaped, and we left the driver, Assad, behind. And that was a difficult decision. You know, I stand by it. He was eventually sort of abandoned by his captors 5 weeks after we escaped. We had sent in a delegation to make sure he could return home. If you want, I can talk about how the Afghan journalist Tahir and I did escape.
Oh, please. Yes, we want to hear that.
What happened was we were moved to this house. We were held basically most of the time in a town called Miranshah, Pakistan, and the last house we were held in was very close and by far the closest to the one local Pakistani military base. Pakistani troops almost never came off that base as far as we could see other than resupply convoys. But the fact that we were so close to it, we thought maybe this is our best chance to escape. And what we did was when our guards were asleep at night, we used a car tow rope that I had found in this house when we moved in. It had been used by Taliban fighters before we arrived, and there were sleeping bags and other equipment lying around. We basically used the car tow rope to lower ourselves down a wall while the guards slept, and then we walked to this Pakistani base. It was roughly 0.3 mile away from our house. When we arrived at the base, the Pakistani soldiers there thought that we were potentially suicide bombers ourselves.
Oh, my gosh.
I had a very long beard at that point. It was dressed in local clothes. We spent 10 minutes standing in the road in front of the base with our hands up. Then they had us lie down on the ground, and then they finally had us take off our shirts to show that we didn't have suicide vests on.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were led on the base, and there was this very brave young Pakistani captain who was on duty at the time. He apologized to me immediately for the kidnapping, and he gave me a book called The Glorious Islam, which was a much more sort of moderate interpretation of Islam. And he, you know, criticized the Taliban, saying that they had distorted his faith and didn't represent his faith, you know, at all. And most importantly, he let me call New York. We were very afraid that another officer would come along who might hand us back to the Taliban, and I called. And my mother-in-law answered the phone.
Right.
Yeah.
Kristen can take the story from
there. My mom, okay. As I mentioned, had been staying with me periodically.
Right.
I was actually out. We live in New York. I was a couple blocks away. So she called me on the cell phone and said, run home. David's escaped, you know. And when I got home, she'd written all the information on a sticky pad. So there were little stickies strewn across the sofa with details of the scout base, that he was in Miranshah. And I called the New York Times, an editor, and one of the people from the Times came over, and the four of us, you know, called Richard Holbrooke, we called Secretary Clinton, and they were able to contact their Pakistani counterparts and say that, you know, they knew David was in Pakistan, they knew exactly where he was, make sure that he gets out of the country alive.
Were you surprised that he escaped?
I was. You know, my two initial thoughts were like, oh, no, that's dangerous, you know, because I really worried he would be handed over to another group or detained for questioning. And then I worried my poor mom was going to have a heart attack because it was a lot of responsibility. But as it progressed and it seemed like we were going to be able to get him out of Pakistan, I mean, I was just elated, and it was the perfect ending to a really long, drawn-out
deal. Oh, my
goodness. You know, we're so thankful that they got nothing. So it was, you know, very, very joyful.
And if you want to, in the book, you see a sign, I think, that you realize you're in Pakistan and you're thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm a dead guy. Being in Pakistan in that particular tribal area was not where you wanted to be held captive.
Yeah, it's this sort of alternate universe that the Taliban have created there. They plan attacks against American forces in Afghanistan. It's still a sanctuary today. Faisal Shahzad, the young man who tried to set off the truck bomb in Times Square that luckily didn't detonate, he was trained in the tribal areas where I was held captive. This young man who tried to set off a bomb recently in Portland, Oregon, at a tree lighting ceremony, he was in touch with some people in Pakistan and trying to reach others. So it's a continuing sort of threat to the United States. And, you know, I live with young men who are being trained to become suicide bombers.
Oh, my gosh. Isn't it hard to take that in, David? The whole thing. It must be. There must be times when you just say, oh, my gosh, what a world.
Well, there was a process and sort of a logic to it. With that suicide bomber, I talked to him and I said, you know, do you really want to die? And he said, you know, absolutely. You know, he said, this world doesn't matter, the next one does. And I said, won't you miss your family? And, you know, he said, no. You know, the only relationship that matters to me is my relationship with God. And I saw how, you know, they systematically kind of brainwash these young kids and break their kind of psychological and emotional bonds with their families. One thing I've found out since is that Saudi Arabia has a program where they try to de-radicalize young men, and one thing they do that helps them is they force the young men to live with their families again, and that helps sort of deprogram them and have them, you know, more focused on reality. But this young man, you know, he believed that American troops were forcibly converting Afghan Muslims to Christianity. He thought that Afghan women were being forced to work as prostitutes on U.S. military bases. And he thought, you know, he asked me, he heard that Christians were just, you know, so enamored with this world and its pleasures. Was it true that, you know, all Christians want to live for 1,000 years?
Wow. Mm-hmm. Did they try to break you?
I'm sorry,
Did they try to psychologically break you?
Oh, to try to break me.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you said. They did, no, they tried to convert me. That was one of their main, efforts. But I don't think they ever tried to psychologically break me. They brought me bottled water. I was never beaten. I think, you know, from a standpoint of just keeping me kind of hopeful and patient and healthy, that, you know, that's what they wanted as in terms of a business transaction. They wanted to, you know, get their money for me. So they did not try to break me. I was allowed to listen to the BBC radio. They brought me English language Pakistani newspapers. I was treated extraordinarily well. So, you know, and I don't think they did it though out of the goodness of their heart. I think.
Oh no,
they wanted their ransom.
It was probably hard to find the goodness of their hearts. And you thought that it might behoove you to be sick, so you pretended that you were sick because they didn't want to have a sick guy held captive.
Right.
Yes, and it didn't matter. They brought doctors. They had Cipro. They had IVs. You know, again, it's this sort of Taliban mini-state inside of Pakistan where they, you know, have all the resources they need. I saw when sometimes they would drive me around, and I saw Taliban road crews at work there, Taliban police, you know, patrolling the streets, and they control the local schools as well.
Hmm. More phone calls for our guests in a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, if not, that's okay. We have plenty to talk about, but we sure would. I know the book just came out, so I would hope a few of you have had a chance to read it. If you haven't, you may want to direct your attention to Afghanistan. Believe me, David knows the whole history here, and he has a look at what's going on not only in Afghanistan, but in that horrendous tribal area in northern Pakistan. I mean, he's got a view of this that very, very, thank God, very few people have to assess where we go from here and what's happened over all of these years. So feel free to pick up on that part of this conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Of course, we want to hear from Kristen, and I'll ask her momentarily what it was like to see each other again, because he's been through hell here, too. How do you adjust? So we'll talk about that and more. We have the co-authors of A Rope and a Prayer with us this hour. David Rode, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and also his new bride. They're still just married. Kristen Mulvihill, who is co-author of this book. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have tons of phone calls coming in now, so we'll be with you momentarily. But we do want to hear, Kristen, let's go to you about seeing each other again, how that took place.
Yes, we were actually reunited in Dubai. I think about, you know, maybe 8 hours after I found out he was out, we spoke once or twice, and the plan was always that I would reunite with him in Dubai. So I flew over. He actually got there before I did. And it was pretty shocking, actually. You know, we had our reunion at the Dubai airport, and I was really struck by how normal he looked. He had had a really long beard during captivity, which I'd seen in video communications from his kidnappers. But when I saw him at the airport, you know, he had shaved the beard. He was in the same clothes he was wearing the day he left New York that fall.
Oh,
and, he had a bouquet of flowers, which is very sweet.
Oh.
And David's brother Lee was with me, and there were several government agents there as well, so it wasn't completely private, but it was very romantic. He came running towards me, and we had a big, long embrace. But I really, you know, after months of kind of worrying he'd be killed at any moment, and a 12-hour flight, I was speechless when I saw him. There was so much to say that I really couldn't think of, you know, the best thing to say. Yeah.
And you had kept apologizing to everybody, David, because you did that interview, and look what happened. It was, you were sorry, you were sorry, you were sorry. Are you over that now?
I'll always regret, you know, going to this interview and not discussing it, most of all, not discussing it with Kristen beforehand. Mm. I mean, that it's, you know, maybe we would have had a conversation and decided it was okay to go, but going without consulting her was wrong, unquestionably. So that's why I guess I apologize. I keep on apologizing
right
to her in particular.
Yeah. You will do pretty much whatever she wants now?
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you know, everyone jokes that the two most important words in marriage are yes, dear. they're absolutely the two most important in marriage.
Right. Okay. Let's go to Tom from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm just wondering what the guest would think if we just left the situation over there.
I fear happen? That there would be terrorist attacks in the United States.
Pardon? I can't hear you. Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, you may have to listen on the radio, if you would, Tom. Go ahead, David.
I do fear that there would be terrorist attacks inside the United States. I believe that, you know, there are al-Qaeda members in the tribal areas of Pakistan. They are kind of brainwashing young Afghans and Pakistanis to join them in their efforts. You know, and again, you know, the case I talked about earlier of Faisal Shahzad. So I do think it would be a base that they would use for attacks inside the United States. I don't think keeping American troops or trying to solve this militarily is the answer either. I think that if the U.S. just continues as it is now, the strategy is not going to work. You know, there's talk about a 2014 handover to Afghan forces. You know, as we talked about earlier, the U.S. has got to train a stronger Afghan army, confront Pakistan, get them to kind of crack down on the Taliban and eliminate these sanctuaries, and confront the Karzai government about corruption. If we don't do those three things, then, you know, I don't think the surge is going to work.
Well, that's a pretty darn tall order.
It is. But, you know, American, you know, young Americans and then hundreds of Afghan and Pakistani moderates are dying as well in this battle. And it's, you know, they're making the ultimate sacrifice. So I think it's vital to have the strongest strategy possible.
Yeah. Mike in Coon Valley. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was wondering if anyone from the government or the military ever contacted David and tried to get some more insight on the Taliban, being that he spent so much time in their presence.
They did, and I it was. I basically looked at the situation that I was a crime victim, and I did speak to, you know, I speak to government officials, I speak to academics that are trying to learn more, journalists that are trying to learn more. I try to be very open and share what I saw, and, you know, and partly in an effort to try to create some kind of positive outcome of what what happened and what my family and my wife went through.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. It's obvious to me why we're in Afghanistan. It was based on 9/11. But I'd like to ask David, I'm not sure. I don't understand. What was the reason that Russia was in Afghanistan? And do you think Afghanistan would actually have been better off if the U.S. hadn't interfered with Russia?
Yeah. The reason Afghanistan, the reason the Soviets invaded Afghanistan was because they were convinced that the Americans, they had bad intelligence and they thought there was going to be a pro-U.S. government installed there, and that was sort of the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union. So they kind of overreacted and invaded. And so that started 30 years of chaos. You know, there was a tribal structure there, a monarchy that ran the country, and it's now a situation where Afghans, there is a lot of corruption, and the sense among Afghans when they get a government post is, I better take everything I can while I can for my family, because they have no sense when there'll be another election, no sense that there'll be, you know, it's a system based on merit, and they're very suspicious of the U.S. that, you know, it'll, you know, again, it's only going to be there for its short-term interests. But and Pakistan, they're also frustrated with the U.S. because they say that the U.S. backed, you know, Islamic militancy in the 80s to fight the Soviets and then sort of abandoned them in the 90s. So there is this sense in the region of, you know, foreign powers coming in and not really, you know, for their own reasons and then leaving them sort of in the lurch. At the same time, you know, the Karzai government has to take responsibility for the corruption that exists there, and they have to do their part, though, as well. I that doesn't, you know, there's no excuse for what's been happening.
Thank you, John, for your call. Was there quite a long period of adjustment when you got back? And I want Kristen to start with this. It seems to me as though if you've been through that kind of horror, that coming back to New York City and going out for coffee and reuniting with your wife you just married might be a difficult thing. Was it or not?
You can go first, Chris.
You know, it was funny because he came back and there was no longer that tension of when was he going to go back to Afghanistan,
right?
To be honest. And I do think the captivity changed him. I mean, it definitely made him appreciate sort of the smaller moments in life and for myself as well. And, you know, a lot of people asked when we were going to be reunited, do you guys want to go away somewhere? Are you going to travel or, you know, go off to some island? And that was the last thing either one of us wanted to do. Mm. We really, you know, I think one of the first things we did was, like, we had coffee. We actually went to the grocery store, too. And it was funny because, you know, before he went away, we have a Whole Foods in the neighborhood, and, you know, he's like, oh, it's so decadent, you know, whatnot. But when he came back from captivity, we walked into that Whole Foods, and he put his arms up in the air, and he was like, this is what is tremendous about our culture, you know, like celebrating innovation. So he was definitely a changed man.
Now, I bet you wish you could have had pictures of this whole thing. It would make a heck of a movie, wouldn't it, David?
Well, people have asked us that, and I'm not. There's not that much interest in a movie, and I'm not interested that much myself. This really wasn't my finest hour. You know, I'm just elated to be home. And the adjustment, you know, I think because we escaped, it was so empowering to have the captivity in that way that, you know, it's in the beginning I had trouble sleeping. I would fear that I would wake up and the whole escape had been a dream. But, you know, the adjustment has been great, and it's, you know, I'm just elated to be home and to be back with Kristen, and, you know, obviously I'm an incredibly lucky person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are. Mm-hmm. Maria is next from Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi, what a wonderful program. Thank you. I look forward to buying the book and reading it. I was just wondering if David has ever had any contact with the author Greg Mortensen, mm-hmm. Three Cups of Tea.
I have not with him directly, but I'm familiar with his work. And go ahead. Do you have a question?
No. I was just wondering your thoughts. It always sounds so hopeful when you hear him speak and the wonderful work he's doing.
I totally support what he's doing, and I absolutely agree with him that his basic philosophy that education is the key. You know, that's absolutely the right tact. Unfortunately, at one point in my captivity, I was held captive in a brand new school that the Pakistani military or the Pakistani government had built in the tribal areas of Pakistan to help educate women Separately, I was held in a brand new health clinic they had built as well that kind of went over hearts and minds. And the problem is, you know, you need a level of security or you simply can't do those aid projects. And the Taliban will simply come in, terrorize local people and take over these schools. And in those cases, they had simply made the school and the health clinic into Taliban commanders had made those buildings into their homes. So he's absolutely right. There's no question that's the long-term solution. You've just got to have a basic level of security to be able to carry out that work.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Maria, for the call. Well, David and Kristen, thank you so much for being with us. It's a captivating story. It's written so well, and you're both pretty courageous people. Well, not pretty. I don't need to qualify that. You are both courageous people. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Our guests this hour, David Rode, Kristen Mulvihill. The book is A Rope and a Prayer, A Kidnapping from Two Sides. It has just been published by Viking and is quite a story because it mixes not only what's going on both sides of this, but it also delves pretty deeply into what's been going on in Afghanistan for a number, or not going on, for a number of years. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and to Chrissy as well for on-air production. We'll be with you tomorrow.